Now okay. Start talking.
Okay, now we're talking. Okay. I'm kind of...
Are we being recorded now?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Hold that thought.
Okay, I'll talk freely.
Yeah, just give us a little segue of what we were just saying in the last 60 seconds, how you get to do ECMO.
Okay, so I work in a unit where we get to do... We do lots of ECMO, but our primary raison d'etre is VA ECMO for cardiorespiratory support. So we look after a lot of sick cardiogenic shocks, post MI, profound cardioplegia, or cardiorespiratory failure post bypass. And these guys are supported with VA ECMO. So it's really, really incredible the kind of stuff you see where I work. I mean, I've seen patients that undoubtedly, if I worked anywhere else, well, bar maybe 4 or 5 other hospitals in the UK, they would be dead. But that in itself brings a whole bunch of emotional, moral, and psychological conundrums.
Yeah, I've been trying to... and still working on trying to get ECMO to my center just for ECPR, for cardiac arrest alone. And it's been just a political and administrative challenge because, as Rory just pointed out, we don't have cardiac surgery in-house, so we don't have already, ECMO bypass in-house. So it's tough to get people on board, even though they get on board a lot easier to just get the latest and the greatest bionic, platinum, tectonic, I don't know what kind of hip replacements for 90-year-olds, for whom it's not a big deal to put in like that $6,000. But for the $1,000 circuit, to save a possible relatively young life, or at least if we look at the CHEER studies ages, that's just, no, we can't start doing that kind of thing.
I mean, problem with ECMO is the data is not... There's not a lot of data, especially in the VA ECPR cohort. What data that is there, though, is amazing and terrifying. So you get... I mean, I think... So if you look at the averages now, excluding the CHEER cohort. The CHEER cohort was an incredible cohort, and it had amazing outcomes. If you look at the out-of-hospital data, and I think the guys who are leading this, like the French guys, so Lionel Lamont, guys like that, you're looking at ROS grades, and of course, I keep forgetting the Taiwanese have a big cohort as well. Their ROS grades, or their survival to hospital discharge rates, are in the order of about 30%.
Wow.
Which some people say, oh my god, that's terrible, right? Survival. That's
incredible.
However, these are people who, without ECMO, their survivals would be 5%.
That's it.
It's less than 1%. I mean, if you're in refractory arrest,
you're
less
dead.
Than 1% survival.
Yeah, you're absolutely dead. And you're absolutely right. Yeah. So, it's a technology that is coming. There is no doubt about this. It is coming. Even if it doesn't come from us, I think patients will demand it. And we've already seen that. We've already seen a few families in our institution. Patient comes in really sick, and then they go away and they Google and they say, oh, there's this technology called ECMO that we could put my relative on. Have you thought about doing that?
Yeah, for sure. That's a social, question, because... At some point, there is the idea of healthcare, sustainability, affordability, and things like that. But then again, look at some of these. Look at some of the costs for some of these cancer treatment drugs that extend your life by months. Not that that's not significant. It is. But the bang for your buck there, if you look at it from a societal standpoint, it costs. It's $1,000 for an ECMO circuit and $100,000 for the machine.
Yeah.
That's like a couple months of some of these modern antibody therapies, which are probably largely overpriced so that someone can really stuff their pockets. And of course, they do have to pay for the R&D and all that. But at some point, I think... But these are tough societal questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another issue might be whether or not a VA ECMO could replace Impella, because that's not free either.
No, so what you're supposed to do, or the new hotness, is both. So
really?
What happens? So you put people on VA ECMO. So VA ECMO is amazing, but it's also terrifying because the complications you get are potentially catastrophic. And one of the scariest ones is the full LV clot. So you get these guys and you put them on VA, especially if you put them on peripheral VA, and the LV doesn't decompress, and so the LV just kind of and especially if they've got no ejection. So they just get stasis in the LV, and then eventually it just turns into clot. And there's some terrifying echo pictures you can find on the internet of a completely clotted LV, and that's just game over. They're just completely dead. There's nothing you can do. So what you need to do is vent the LV. Mm-hmm. So some people are using balloon pumps, but the new sexiest way to do it was an impeller. And that completely decompresses the LV, and there's a couple of cases coming out showing improved LV dimensions. And I'm not sure if this translates to improved survival, because I think the case numbers are small. But yeah, so you combine ECMO and impeller, and it's like, yeah, that's the caviar at the moment of cardiovascular support. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess that correlates with improved hemolysis.
Pardon?
I'm going to guess that causes improved hemolysis.
That's another cut of fish. The coagulation, the hemolysis problems, the strokes, the bleeds, the bleeding. Of course, they bleed. Yeah, they bleed.
So, but you were saying you think VV ECMO is on its way out?
Yeah. I think, again, this is non-substantiated. If you look overall, so I think VV ECMO works. No doubt about it. If you've got somebody who you just cannot ventilate safely, they just collapse in a heap. They get core pulmonary, and then their RV fails, and it's absolutely terrible. You can put a VV cannula in and watch the inotropes melt away, and the patient literally comes back to life in front of your eyes. However, if you look at the proportion of people who get severe enough ARDS now to require VV ECMO, I think it's shrinking. Mm-hmm. And I think it's shrinking because we're getting a lot better at managing the... So, traditional management of sepsis, you came in, you had septic shock, you got 20 liters of fluid, your lungs filled up, and then we put a tube down and we ventilated you, and we called it ARDS, and we ventilated you at really high pressures, and then you got really bad ventilation-induced lung injury, and then you ended up needing some kind of rescue therapy, whether that was nitric, proning, whatever. We're getting so much better with the upfront fluid therapy and with the conservative fluid therapy on the unit and with ventilating people really carefully. That kind of ARDS, the numbers that you see that are like that are really few and far between. So I think, you know, unlike before when, you know, we were all worried about flu and we thought there was going to be this massive rush of people with severe respiratory failure needing VV ECMO on every street corner, I think that VV ECMO cohort is actually going to shrink and become a very specialist cohort that will be managed in maybe large heart lung units, etc., etc., etc. The real expansion I see coming is the VA ECMO cohort, the cardiac arrests in young people who we could make live if we get to them and cannulate them within 60 minutes.
Yeah.
So, again, you know, this is all completely unfounded. I would love to be challenged. I'm actually going to be chatting. I'm going to be on a podcast with a couple of guys from one of the big VV ECMO units in the UK in a couple of weeks. So, well, we'll talk a bit about, well, some of this stuff might come up, but those are just kind of my private thoughts at the moment. Well, they were my private thoughts, and I've shared them with
everyone. It does raise some interesting EBM issues. I mean, whether or not you have an RCT, if you're keeping someone alive who obviously would have died otherwise, you can, you know, kind of invoke the whole parachute argument.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I think you get into that case of the pseudo parachute argument, right? And it's all about patient selection. And if you actually look at the data on VA ECMO for cardiac arrest, it's really interesting because they'll come out with studies that say you have worse survival. And when you look at the cohorts they select, it's patients. It's just a general group of VFib, VTAC, shockable rhythm patients, and of course you're going to have worse survival than them, right? Because if you get on their chest and shock them once and they get ROSC, then they're going to do better than if you have to put them on pump. Whereas if you look at the refractory VFib, VTAC, where, you know, they're in refractory arrest, you've shocked them 7 or 8 times and you can't get them out, their survival is around 1%, so a 30 or 40% survival is amazing. I guess my question is, where's that tipping point?
Yeah.
At what point in the arrest is it better to transport them to a VA center than it is to stay and play for long? Sure. And I don't think we have that data yet.
The other interesting thing that throws a spanner in the works in the way we understand this stuff is the rise of the VAD. So in the UK, VADs, visual ventricular assist devices, have just been So, you know, we have what you guys call the death panel, or the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, who kind of, they look through all the treatments and they decide whether it achieves a certain threshold of cost effectiveness. So VADs have just been approved in the UK as effective for destination therapy. Mm-hmm. So that means one of the barriers, or one of the things that we think would be a bad idea of putting people on VA ECMO, which is the kind of, you end up in this refractory heart failure state. If you can support these guys with VAD, and as VAD technology gets better and better, and the VADs stop failing and don't clot as much and stuff like that, then we have a viable option for all these guys.
Do you come across that? I mean, that is never one of our concerns when deciding who to put on. Because I don't know the exact data, but from what I remember reading, so few of them end up with real heart failure where you need to bridge them to VAD. A lot, most of them, you have pretty good recovery at 2 weeks.
Yeah, true.
I guess our concern is always, do they have enough blood flow to their brain while they were down?
That is the big kicker. It's cerebral and hypoxic brain injury. And bleeding, of course.
I think one of the things that people don't realize as sort of consciously is that the ROSC post ACLS is not the same physiology as the ROSC when you, well, not really ROSC, but not the same thing as when you turn on that ECMO machine and now you have nearly vasopressor free flow, or because they tend to not give epi at all when they're headed that way, or almost none, versus someone who just gets, you know, ROSC, but they've got like 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 milligrams of epi on board. The microcirculation isn't quite the same.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that, because even if you stop giving epi when you decide to cannulate, they usually still have the 7 milligrams of epi sitting in their right atrium that hasn't really gone anywhere, because it's not circulating despite CPR. And then as soon as we get them on pump, they're... maps are in the 150s, and we actually usually have nicardipine hanging because we have to give them some nicardipine because the pumps hate afterload. It would be nice if we stopped giving epi, and maybe when Paramedic 2 comes out and we have a little more data.
I think that's this year, isn't it?
They said it would be out, I think, by April or May. They'll stop collecting the data, and later this year it should be out.
Because I know when Joe and Zach could come up and presented and chat about ECMO, they were saying how if they really think it's headed the ECMO route, there's just no more epi. And so sometimes they've done a couple of cases that are like, no epi. Because they're like, this is a really young person. This one's going on, you know, unless just, you know, CPR does it. And they're like, no epi.
Yeah, especially because all the data we're seeing that epi decreases blood supply to the brain. And, you know, if you're not getting them back without ECMO, then I'm sure it's really buying you.
So yeah, I don't know. I'm getting a business case together for ECMO for a unit it's complex.
Yeah.
Well, you probably need a mix of different things. You need patient stakeholders. You need.
That's it.
You need patient involvement. And then you need an index case. You need a win. You need to have that one case, or you have a case that you present that could have survived with ECMO, and then you need to do one and show that this case survived with ECMO.
Yeah, it is a bit of a political show.
Yeah, and then you need the cardiac surgery and vascular support.
That's not going to happen since we don't have cardiac surgery. And vascular, I don't know. We'll see. But I'm actually going I want to go the local community crowdfunding type of thing, and then once the money's there, hopefully then the hospital can really do a little to refuse it. Hopefully.
Another question would be, like, could you get your cardiologist on board to support high risk PCI? Because I feel like if you could get any local, you know, cardiac, you know, CT surgery cardiologist to kind of ally with you, that could help a lot.
Yeah, we actually have that. The cardiologist, they would be on board with that. It's not an issue. And we were fortunate to physically be close to the Heart Institute that has the same cardio help system. So our idea would be just, you know, put it in the eMERGE, you know, turn it on, ship them out to where they can, you know, do emergency PCI. It's just a few blocks away.
What do the heart guys do? Will they come out and do retrievals and stuff like that?
No, it's not developed like that.
They have an ECMO retrieval service in New Zealand, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very successful from what I can see. Maybe the way to deal with the big geography.
Yeah, so we have a respiratory failure ECMO service, ECMO retrieval service in the UK. So they're kind of 5 or 6 centres that will... So, you know, you call them up. If you're a regional hospital, you call them up and say, I've got this person who I can't ventilate. They've got their PF ratio is 1 and, you know, they're, you know, and I've probed them and I've APR'd them and I don't know what else to do. And they fill out, you fill out the form and they go through the referral form, and then an hour later somebody shows up with a, you know, with a bunch of kit, and they'll cannulate them on, they'll cannulate them in your hospital and then take them off for management. And that worked quite well. That came out of the H1N1 epidemic and the Caesar trial.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's also an idea, and that's something that could work.
Interesting stuff. All right, let's get back to the conference.